For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're talking about the experience of being a blind author. Verity Smith reveals how she used a variety of voices to write her autobiography, The Groper's Guide. Campaigning Paralympian Mike Brace tells us how humour helps get his message across. And I dust off a hidden gem that helped me come to terms with my own blindness. All that and more coming up on today's Read On. Verity Smith is an international dressage rider, singer-songwriter and author who is living proof of the ability within disability. Despite having Stargardt's, she's represented Team GB at the World Games, regularly competes against sighted riders, and hopes one day to represent Great Britain in the Able-Bodied Olympics. Her book, The Groper's Guide, is the first part of her autobiography and offers a very humorous insight into the hidden world of the unseen. Verity, thank you so much for joining us on Read On Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you begin The Groper's Guide by telling the audience exactly what the physical challenges of being a blind author are. Could you outline some of those to us?
Well, for a start, obviously writing, handwriting, which is actually how I normally would process my thoughts, if you like. Things come out much clearer if I write things by hand. It's quite tricky when you can't see, and I wrote an entire chapter with a pen that wasn't working at one point. Computers, when I actually wrote The Groper's Guide, they were great, but I wasn't really a fay with the technology and JAWS and all the sort of screen reader stuff. So I decided to go back to old tried and true methods. I was very used to dictating because I had an amanuensis through my exams. But I got very bored of my own voice. So I ended up actually doing chapter by chapter with different accents just to keep myself motivated and to keep myself not from nodding off at my own sort of mutterings. I think now I am actually much more a fay with the screen readers, so I have actually been writing the follow-up with the computer. And the sadness with that is, of course, that every time the computer reads back what I've written, all its sort of dynamic, sort of emotional or humorous nuances are completely killed by the voice of what sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
There's an awful lot of humour, obviously, talking to you now. I can hear that's very natural. Did you find it easier to remember the happy moments of going blind rather than the sad ones?
The gift that I had was that I began to lose my sight as a child. Children have this incredible resilience, and you don't see something as a problem. You see it as something you've just got to get used to and work through. And there were dark moments. Of course there were. I mean, there are moments of frustration. I think it's an instant, oh, gosh, why can't I do this? But I think I had this resilience. So, yeah, I mean, I think I just looked at it as a game that I was going to play, and I wanted to play it well.
I think you certainly capture the surreal aspect of not really being the native. You get mixed messages from your brain. You kind of think you should be able to see this man who's giving you a diagnosis, and then you equate him with one of the characters in The Muppets.
Stargardt's. I heard Professors Bird and Arden proclaim in triumphant unison from the opposite side of the desk at Moorfields. I sat watching them, gently ebbing in and out of focus across the sea of formica and papers that lay between us, and wondered for a moment what on earth the two men diagnosing my future actually looked like. They had spent the best part of a week under my scrupulous observation, as had I under theirs. Yet despite my valiant efforts, their faces remained as bleached and featureless as the white coats they wore. From where I was sitting, through the vaporous fog that had manifested itself over my eyes, the two professors looked rather like the two old gents in the balcony from The Muppet Show, jeering backwards and forwards, their rubber mouths grinning broadly at me. How strange, I thought, to learn my fate from such an unlikely pair. I let out a little giggle and instantly felt Mum's fanged stiletto jab irritably into my left foot. "Are you listening?" she said in an unnaturally calm voice. I was vaguely, but in truth, I was more intent on looking.
I think this is the thing. I think when you have been able to see, the visual memories I have are very much the visual memories of a child. Mm. So my brain still wants to paint the colours. It still wants to create the images. And often I'm surrounded by cartoon characters.
Do you think that that ability to live straddling two worlds like that, do you think it lends itself to fiction? And do you think you'd ever turn your hand to fiction?
Maybe one day in the future, if I come up with something that really, you know, a seed of an idea that really, really does have the possibility to grow into something special.
One passage that did really make me giggle was when you were studying Wuthering Heights.
When I was learning Braille at school, I basically was told to find books that I enjoyed to try and inspire me to read more, because I was so absolutely not interested in Braille at all. For me, it was, as I said in the book, it was a paper with a rash that I took an instant allergy to. So I decided I was actually going to read Wuthering Heights, because I loved Wuthering Heights, and I was doing it for part of my A-levels at school. And I thought I'd take it on holiday with me, and I think it was about 15 volumes for one. It was a disaster. But the other book that I decided I would scoop up was Midsummer Night's Dream. And I don't know if... did you read this bit? This is awful. I defaced all the books in the library by accident. I had beautiful nails because apparently I was spelling the top line of the dots above the one I was reading. But unfortunately, Puck... features quite a lot in Midsummer Night's Dream, and it's one of the plays that the younger members of the school would actually do, because it was a simpler play. And anyway, I popped the book back in the library. My English teacher came up to me and he said, "Verity, did you read Midsummer Night's Dream over the half term?" And I said, "Oh yes, I did actually." And he said, "Yes, you've removed the lower dot three from all the P's of Puck." I'm like, "Oh!"
No.
And so it became a letter F. So, yeah, I loved the art of literature, but I struggled with the medium through which to appreciate the art.
It clearly never put you off reading, though.
No.
Are you still a voracious reader?
As a blind person, for me, I mean, back to something like Wuthering Heights and Tessa the D'Urbervilles, books like that that have the most incredible description of landscape and place. To hear it described in such beautiful language, in such detail, I think is such a gift to people that can't see. Because for me, you know, the author really does paint a picture of something which is invisible otherwise. It really does transport me out of my disability and also into the sighted world, you know.
Yes, and I think that comes through very strongly from your writing. You're creating a two-way road back to the sighted world, but also for the sighted world to come into our world and try and understand what it is to be a blind person.
I think it's really important to explain to people that, you know, it's not just as simple as closing your eyes and navigating, you know, the room, because we do use, you know, if you have a little shred of something, you use it to the maximum of your ability to create the vision in front of you. And it may not be entirely visual, but that little bit of vision that you have does actually paint a stronger picture with your other senses. You know, if you know it's day and you know it's night, I mean, I think it must be very, very difficult if you are black blind to not have that perception of light and dark. For me, that's the access of my senses, you know. And I think if you can explain that in a way that isn't scary to people who can see, their understanding, and I think often the way to do that is through humour. I think humour is a very disarming mechanism with which you invite people in, as opposed to tell them what it is and expect them to accept it. You actually invite them to come and, you know, have a little piece of how it feels, and it's not all dark and gloomy and scary. Yes, of course, at times it is, especially if you're at Covent Garden Tube Station, it can be quite nerve-wracking. But, you know, generally there are very positive sides to it too. And I think this is where writing is so important, because it does engage our other senses. You know, when somebody writes beautifully about food, I feel starving, you know, my mouth is watering, I can taste the food. I'm, you know, when someone describes a beautiful landscape, you know, same thing, you can hear, you can sense, you can taste, you can feel. And I think, although it is a physical act of reading, there is this, it's probably the one medium that opens up all our other senses as well.
Language is the ultimate way of expressing your individuality, and the gift of being able to do that, I think, is a bit of a lifesaver for some of us.
Absolutely, I agree. And I think it's just something, I think it's an art, you know, book readings where you go and, I love that, when you go and listen to the author reading the book. I think it's a gift that may have derailed for a wee while, but has come back into fashion. And I love that. I think it's so inspiring.
So on the programme, we have a feature called Books of My Life. Typically, one from childhood, a rainy day book, and a book read recently to share with the listeners. So without wishing to put you on the spot, Verity Smith, does anything spring to mind?
I would say the most inspiring book for me as a child was a book called The Velveteen Rabbit. It's a beautiful story about a little boy's toy rabbit that he loved and loved and loved, and he had measles. Unfortunately, not the toy rabbit, but the little boy, and all his toys got thrown away and burnt. And the little Velveteen Rabbit was put out into the garden, and he became real because he'd been loved so much. And it was a book for me as a child that possibly, I think, going, obviously with going blind, it was a book that made me think there's no such thing as an end, there's always a beginning. And it took away the fear of a lot of uncertainty, and it's just a really warm, beautiful book. Ooh, my Curl Up and Rainy Day book, gosh. Actually, it's by Gerald Durrell, and it's called My Family and Other Animals. And it's a very easy read, but it's a very humorous read, and it's about a boy discovering his love of animals, his love of everything extraordinary, and just the wonder. It's a book that just takes you out of yourself. It makes you feel that, oh my gosh, my family's really weird, and so is his. It's just a really easy, fun book. I would say my life-changing book is a book called The Alchemist. It's about a man's journey, and what I love about this book, it's a very comforting book because it tells me that we can journey, we can travel, but we need to actually find who we are and where we are within ourselves, because often we're too busy running and we're too busy looking and we're not actually seeing. There's a real peace in it, a real sense of peace when you come to the end of the book. You realise, oh, he's almost been chasing his tail, but he's had wonderful experiences, and perhaps if he hadn't done that journey, he wouldn't have ever come back and realised that that's who he was. But it's a very, very beautiful book, and it's a very small book, it's a very skinny book, but it's definitely one that's a life changer, I would say.
Thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with us, and for sharing some of the story behind The Groper's Guide.
Lovely to speak with you, Red. Bye-bye.
Verity's joyous autobiography, The Groper's Guide, is available from the RNIB Library, and Lucy Scott's narration of it is brilliant. Have you written about how you see life? Maybe you write a blog, or you've published a book. We'd love to hear from you. The email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Being blind, I'm not a regular cinema goer. In fact, in the last 10 years, I've only been twice. The last time was when I was lucky enough to be invited to the premiere of Notes on Blindness,
which was later broadcast by the BBC as part of its Storyville series.
Robert Kirkwood explores the written story behind the film.
As we're talking today about books by blind authors, we must mention Touching the Rock by John Hull, which became the inspiration for the film Notes on Blindness.
This is cassette one, track one, Notes on Blindness.
July the 5th, 1984.
What happens to the brain when optic stimulation ceases?
I am concerned to understand blindness.
The pictures in the gallery of my mind have dimmed somewhat, so I could no longer remember easily what my wife looked like or what my daughter Imogen looked like.
I began to be terribly afraid that I would lose you.
Everything was drifting away. How could this happen to me? Who had the right to deprive me of the sight of my children at Christmas time?
After losing sight, John Hull knew that if he did not try to understand blindness, it would destroy him. In 1983, he began keeping an audio diary. Over 3 years, John recorded over 16 hours of material, a unique testimony of loss, rebirth and renewal, excavating the interior world of blindness. Published in 1990, the diaries were described by author and neurologist Oliver Sacks as a masterpiece, the most precise, deep and beautiful account of blindness I have ever read. The RNIB Talking Book version is read by Nigel Graham.
What is the world of sound? I've been spending some time out of doors trying to respond to the special nature of the acoustic world. I'm impressed by the many different aspects of reality, the range and depth of the contact points between myself and something created by sound.
A unique exploration of that distant, infinitely strange other world of blindness. John Hull writes of odd sounds and echoes, of people without faces, of a curious new relationship between waking and dreaming, of a changed perception of nature and human personality. He reveals a world in which every human experience, eating and lovemaking, playing with children and buying drinks in a bar, is transformed.
The tangible world sets up only as many points of reality as can be touched by my body. And this seems to be restricted to one problem at a time. I can explore the splinters on a park bench with the tip of my finger, but I cannot at the same time concentrate on exploring the pebbles with my big toe. I can use all 10 fingers when I'm exploring the shape of something, but it's quite difficult to explore 2 objects simultaneously, one with each hand. It's true that if many people were poking me, I would feel all the prods with various parts of my body, but this would not tell me very much about the world, only about my body.
Be thunder without any light.
Now I find that there's been a strange kind of change in the state of my brain. There is something so totally purging about blindness that one either is destroyed or renewed.
Following on from the Emmy Award-winning short film of the same name, the movie Notes on Blindness, which is based on the book Touching the Rock and the audio recordings, is an ambitious and groundbreaking work, both affecting and innovative, and it also comes with an additional virtual reality experience, which we'll hear about in a moment. It won the Best Documentary at the British Independent Film Awards and was nominated recently for 3 BAFTAs, including Best Documentary and Outstanding British Film. James Spinney is one of the writers and directors of the film, and he told us when their journey with the film began.
Just over 5 years ago, really, James and myself, we came across John's book, a book called Touching the Rock, which was published in the early 1990s. And we were immediately struck by the kind of the depths of insight and precision in which John was able to kind of articulate his experience of blindness. And in the foreword to the book, it mentioned that it was based on these audio cassettes, these audio diaries, which John kept after losing his sight between 1983 and 1986. And so we reached out to him, really. We got in contact with him and built up a relationship about over 6 months or so, after which John was generous enough to share with us this box of C90 cassettes, these original audio cassettes that had been kind of gathering dust on a shelf in his office for the best part of 30 years. And the project kind of developed from there. I suppose as filmmakers, we're very much interested in other people's experiences and perspectives of the world. And that's what initially got us interested in blindness. We were thinking, actually, there was a project we were initially researching around the blind experience of snowfall. And that's how we first got in contact with John and we were first led to his book, Touching the Rock. John had been kind of talking about his experience of blindness for at least 20 years, I suppose, by the time we came across his book. Since then, he'd often been kind of called to speak about his experiences and been involved in a number of radio pieces and TV documentaries as well. So it was something he was quite familiar with, in a sense. I think he was initially a little bit surprised that this material had the kind of legs in it to hold a feature-length documentary. But he was incredibly supportive and incredibly engaged. And it became very much a kind of collaborative process, actually, over the course of the years. We spent a lot of time with John and with his wife, Marilyn, encouraging them to sort of reprocess these events, really, and sift through this material together. So yeah, it became a bit of a sort of a joint enterprise in that respect, and one that in some way we hope that the project became for him a kind of an extension of his own personal project of communicating his experience of blindness to others.
Pete Middleton is the other writer and director, and talked about both the virtual reality experience and how they selected which audio to use in the film.
It's a process that took a number of years. John kept 16 hours of diary recordings across that three-year period between 1983 and 1986. And at times it was a deeply frustrating one because there's so much fascinating material, much of which couldn't make it into the eventual feature film, which was actually partly the motivation for us developing a virtual reality project alongside the feature film. The virtual reality experience uses some extracts from John's diaries that aren't in the film, particularly extracts that focus more on his kind of sensory understanding of the world and the development of what he came to call acoustic space, so how different multi-layer patterns of sound gave him a sense of depth and detail and contour to the world. Both the virtual reality experience and the feature film are both narrated by John from the recordings that he kept in the early 1980s, but they take quite different approaches. So whereas the feature film uses actors Dan Skinner and Simone Kirby to play John and his wife Marilyn, and Dan and Simone are lip-syncing on screen to these original recordings, whereas the virtual reality experience is in some ways more of a first-person experience. So it places you within these 3D sound environments and you have a kind of spatial relationship with the sounds around you. So one of the chapters describes John's experience in a park, talking about how the sound of his children's footsteps and the traffic beyond and the sounds of boats rowing on the lake all give him a sense of a panorama of music and information, which he finds absorbing. John also describes how the sound of wind brings leaves and trees back into existence and how thunder puts a roof over his head. And the final chapter of the experience is in a choir where he's listening to a group of singers, and he considers the fact that he doesn't feel that his experience is in any way diminished by the absence of a visual equivalent, and how increasingly he feels that he's no longer someone who's disabled by some kind of incapacity, but he feels like he's empowered by a new ability, and he feels like his intellectual work, his academic work, is reaching a focus that he feels he might not have been able to achieve had he retained sight. And this is a really important part of John's journey, I think, is that though initially he began keeping the diaries because he was grieving his sighted life, over the course of a three-year period, he feels that there's this sense of transformation in his whole sort of state of consciousness. And the diaries chart his discovery of what he comes to call a world beyond sight. And by the end of the diaries, he's even come to consider blindness as what he calls a paradoxical gift, around which he's redefined his life.
The film is available on demand and on DVD now with three different soundtracks, the original soundtrack, an enhanced audio soundtrack, and with audio description. For more information, you can head to notesonblindness.co.uk. And the RNIB Talking Book version is available from the RNIB Library, narrated by Nigel Graham. It's Talking Book number 8158.
I think I am beginning to understand what it's like to be blind.
My thanks to Robert, and if you haven't already caught it, Notes on Blindness is still available on Netflix. With its enhanced features like audio description, it's the perfect bridge between film and talking books. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. As many of us know, Mike Brace has been a tireless advocate for Paralympic sport for many years.
He represented Great Britain in 1976 in the first Winter Paralympics as a cross-country skier, and continued to compete and work within the British Paralympic Association, eventually becoming its chairman. In 2009, he was awarded the MBE for services to Paralympic sport. He published the first volume of his autobiography, Where There's a Will, in 1980. It tells the story of how he was blinded by a firework at the age of 10 and of his determination to adapt and lead as normal a life as possible. Certainly, blindness has not stood in the way of his success. And the sequel, Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog, is a very humorous account of his determination to lead by example.
Despite my doubts and experience at the interview, I was still more than a little surprised when I got the job at the new Regional Assessment Centre in Hackney. On the one hand, it was a sense of going home, i.e. working back in Hackney, only a few hundred yards from where I had my accident and had lost my sight. On the other hand, I was ready for a new challenge, and this new job would certainly provide it. So I decided to go for it.
John Banks narrating Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog, written by Mike Brace, who joins me now. Mike, welcome.
Thanks very much indeed.
I thoroughly enjoyed reading the first volume of your autobiography. You write with a really refreshing lack of sentimentality for your loss of sight and a real can-do sort of attitude. Is that something that came from your East End upbringing or something that you've acquired as somebody who's had to adjust all your life?
I think probably a bit of both. When I lost my sight, I think I had that mentality that, you know, I wanted to show people what you could do and really got affronted, I suppose, by the attitudes that I experienced, really. You know, the notion of not understanding what sight loss meant, but also then all the assumptions that people then made, that you were disabled but not unable. And I think when they made those assumptions as a 10 or 11 or 12 year old, that really fired me up to say, well, I shall prove you wrong.
That certainly comes through in Where There's a Will. Did you feel that the young man writing 37 years ago had reached the right conclusions, or did you feel that some of your thoughts had changed since then when you were writing for the sequel?
I think things have changed or improved in certain elements, but, you know, I remember trying to get information around, you know, what I could do was pretty scant and pretty limited. I remember because I'd managed to get some exams at the school, I was regarded as a success from school. I regarded myself as a survivor from the school rather than... And then obviously all the employment options that were open to me, some of those have deteriorated since, and I'm not sure the employment prospects now are that much greater than they were 40 years ago, 45 years ago when I was trying to get into employment. So some of the same issues are still there, and some of the solutions may have changed, but not a great deal.
I must say I was quite shocked to read of a slope of expectations down which you slipped when you went from partially sighted school to blind school.
And limited expectations. Limited, you know, the school teachers were not pushing the horizons that many of us could have aspired to. And in those days there was a sort of streaming out to the two grammar schools, Chorley Wood for girls and Worcester for the boys. I wasn't really that fussed or energised into trying to pass any exams. And then the expectation for anyone that didn't get through that hoop were very limited in terms of what was expected or what was then tried or put forward as an option.
And you write very movingly about the impact on your family. I think you write, blindness might have changed my life, but it shattered my mother's.
That's where I think things probably have improved a bit, in that there was very little, if any, thought for my parents or wider circle of family in terms of help, support, information, advice. Certainly she was very isolated, very alone. She didn't know anyone that was vision impaired. She didn't have any people that knew people that were vision impaired. Very often you have to be the sort of stoic person coping really for your family's sake. So you almost feel guilty if you show them just how desperate you're feeling at times, because you know they won't be able to cope with it. And I just remember that. I remember feeling that I couldn't be depressed or unhappy or say how bad things have got on the few occasions they did get bad, because I knew the people around me probably wouldn't be able to cope with it. And because mine was an accident, it was particularly powerful, because it was someone sticking a firework in a medicine bottle and screwing the lid on, and being a nosy 10-year-old picking the bottle up that then exploded in my face. She did have this amazing sense of guilt that somehow, being my mum, it was her responsibility to stop bad things happening to me.
I also wonder whether competitive sport as a way of crushing down the pain of loss.
I think there's certainly an element of that. For me, sport was a way of re-establishing my sense of self, really, and saying, well, actually, I know I can do this, and I can do this pretty well. For me as a youngster, you know, testing out my ability as opposed to wondering what my disability was, that was powerful. And the second part of that then was it then started to challenge people's concepts of your disability, because you were then showing them again your ability.
You're building your own self-confidence, and as you walk taller, people look at you differently, don't they?
Yeah.
I was wondering how much your training as a shorthand typist had made you accurate the first time round that you record your thoughts.
I didn't use shorthand in so much to write it down and then type it out. I did type it straight onto a typewriter. I largely wrote as I thought, and I think that sometimes is a plus in terms of style and the way things come over, but sometimes then it's not the most literate way of recording your thoughts.
It comes across as very fluent, and actually it's got a pace to it. As I mentioned in the introduction, we've got both volumes of your memoirs in the RNIB library, and I've got to ask, where did the title of Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog come from?
I applied for a guide dog because I wanted to do more things, walking around, going across open spaces, and I thought probably a dog would be a much easier option than using a cane. But the downside of that was the amazing attitude of everyone around you, that they do think that the dog knows everything. Someone asked me, when you get to the traffic lights, does it know green, red and amber are the traffic lights and know when to cross? And I then said to someone, oh, there's no point in asking me, ask the dog.
People expect you to have something that's a cross between Lassie and a sat-nav.
Yes.
And
yes.
Any chance of a novel coming from Mike Brace?
Yeah, it's something I've often toyed with the idea. Not quite sure what sort of genre, really, whether it would be a detective or I don't know, really. I've got to sort of sit down and think what sort of issues I've dealt with that I could probably wax lyrical on in a book.
Mike Brace, thank you very much for sharing some insights into your two books. And thank you also for helping me be able to laugh at my own blindness.
Great pleasure. Great pleasure.
And both of Mike's books, Where There's a Will and Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog, are available in Braille and as talking books from the RNIB library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Talking Books has two shows per day, one at 8 a.m. and the other at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm delighted to be reading the talking books.
Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library morning, afternoon or evening.
This is Julia Donaldson and you're listening to Talking Books.
And for younger listeners or the young at heart, Children's Talking Books is on every Saturday at 9, Sunday at 3 or Tuesday at 6 p.m. Books for all ages all through the day, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
Sue Townsend, who sadly died in 2014, was best known as the creator of Adrian Mole. In 2001, she contributed an essay to the RNIB's Sightlines book, which is a collection of writing by various authors. In it, she wrote about her own battle with sight loss. It's read by Jacqueline King.
The card came in the post in a cheap brown envelope. I didn't open it for a few days. It looked like a newsagent's bill. When I finally opened it, I found a pink laminated card inside. It said, "This is to certify that Mrs. Susan Townsend of Homefield Road, Leicester, has been certified as eligible for registration as a partially sighted person under the National Assistance Act, 1948, by Mr. ... consultant ophthalmologist, and agreed to be registered on 22/7/1999. On the other side of the card, in larger, bolder print, it said, "Partially sighted person's registration card." There was no covering letter. There was nothing to soften the blow. When I was a child, I noticed things. The exact pattern of the bark on a tree, the colour of a wet pavement, the elegant curve of peeling paint as it drew away from a gatepost. The twice-daily trudge to school was made bearable by such visual delights. I used to watch the way the sun moved across the sky and changed the look of my world as it did so. I soon learnt not to share my observations with other children. They seemed not to be interested in such things. I began to think instead, and this thinking turned into a constant interior monologue, and without realizing it, I became a writer, though I didn't dare write anything down until I was 14. I know what it's like to be regarded as stupid. I was 8 and a half before I could read the simplest words. Mrs. Ralph's reading lessons became an ordeal. For almost 3 years, I sat with the same reading book open on the desk, mouthing words I could not read. "Look, Janet, look, see the ball. Look, John, see the dog." Mrs. Ralph's ferocious temper terrified me. To be chosen by her to read aloud in class became my greatest fear. I dreaded going to school. If we small children made a mistake of any kind, she would exert a strange punishment. After a tirade of shouted sarcasm, she would order the offending children to stand on their hands, and then, while upside down, resting their feet against the classroom wall, she would then slap our thighs with the flat of her hand. For us girls, this was a double ordeal. All girls wore skirts in the 1950s, and when we were upside down, our skirts fell over our heads, blinding us. This combination of pain, humiliation, and darkness is used by evil regimes throughout the world to intimidate and bully the powerless and the weak. Since I was a child, I have rarely slept in darkness. I suppose I fear the dark. My sight has deteriorated further since I received that curt pink card. I am now technically blind. I have protected myself very well from the reality of my situation. I call myself a Blinky or a Mrs. Magoo. I push negative or pessimistic thoughts out of my mind as soon as they surface. But very occasionally, reality rears up and slaps me in the face. The plain truth is that nothing can compensate for sight. I mourn the lack of detail. I can, of course, remember 100,000 details, but I'm still hungry for more. I have always written in block letters, in thick black ink, on lined paper, as recommended by the RNIB. The difference now is that on this day, 16th of November, I cannot read the writing I have written without a huge magnifying glass. And after a retinal hemorrhage, I throw my words into the dark and can only hope that the words are reproduced faithfully. On more than a few occasions, I have felt sorry for myself and cried hot, fat tears. The first time I failed to tell the difference between a daffodil and a tulip without touching them was a bad day. The garden was sunny at the time. Sunshine is the enemy of those of us with diabetic retinopathy. We welcome that grey English light that makes sighted people melancholy. Dawn and twilight are our friends. The pity of people is sometimes hard to bear. A woman approached me recently after I had made a slightly stumbling public appearance in a blindingly sunny room. She gushed, "I just want to say that I think you're very, very brave." I felt a surge of anger towards her and wanted to shout, "I'm not brave, you fool. I have no bloody choice but to carry on." But of course I didn't. There is a lot of sentimental nonsense talked about blindness. But oh, it is so painful to look and look at your garden and still not be able to see it. and it makes you want to shout violent, cruel words to the people who suggest that one day you will be content to touch and to smell instead of seeing your precious plants. I still want to see the exquisite elegance of a lily and the vibrant green of an Acer. I was being driven through a tiny hamlet in Leicestershire last year when I remarked to my husband on the surprising preponderance of Asian and black people on the streets. My husband informed me kindly that all the people on the street were white. So there are some compensations. I now live in a melting pot world where everyone has the same colour skin. There are certain privileges that partially sighted and blind people enjoy. The talking book service is one. I recently listened to 27 and a half hours of John Updike's Rabbit masterpiece, and being a fundamentally lazy person, I was glad to be relieved of all that dreary page-turning. Instead, I lay in bed and was told a story. It was a total delight. Since being diagnosed, I have written a 6-part TV series. I plan to replant my garden with those loud, vibrant coloured flowers I had previously disliked. And perhaps I flatter myself, but I think I can still see ever so slightly more than most people with perfect sight.
Sightlines is available from the RNIB Library as TB12555. And you can find all of Sue Townsend's Adrian Mole books and much of her other work there too in a range of accessible formats. This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Diane Woodford's book, Living with Sight Loss, A Type 1 Diabetic's Life Story, was published in 2016 and tells how she regained her independence after quite literally losing her sight overnight.
What do you do when you wake up and your whole world has changed? Your first reaction might be to try and change it back again. This was certainly my first thought on Sunday, the 26th of August 2007, when I woke up to find that I'd lost the majority of my sight. I could make out where my window was and that it was light outside. However, for some reason, I couldn't see items in my bedroom clearly, and I felt like I was shrouded in darkness. My brain was certainly confused. I tried rubbing my eyes, but to no effect. I wondered whether maybe my eyes didn't want to wake up at the same time as my body this morning. I got out of bed and stumbled and felt my way to the bathroom. I felt scared as I washed my face with cold water, rubbing water onto my eyes in particular. I then looked in the mirror, but I couldn't see myself. It was although the mirror was steamed up after a shower or a bath.
So, Diane, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you.
Tell me, as a blind writer, did you find it physically difficult to write and to edit it?
I did find it really difficult at first. I used talking computer software, JAWS, and I think writing the book, I did it with my partner to help me, and we found the best way for me was for me to record what I wanted to say and then for him to type it up, because he quite likes doing that. And then I felt it was easy to get everything out, what I wanted to say.
Did you have any biographies that you had read or listened to in mind as you were writing your own story?
I found it quite hard to find biographies from blind people. So that sort of inspired me to write the book.
What do you think was the biggest factor in you regaining your independence?
My need to make family life as normal as possible for two teenagers and a toddler. I was a single mum at the time, and to get my sort of life back into a normal running, I wanted to make everything as normal as possible for them. You know, one of the things my mum said when she visited me in the hospital when I first lost my sight was, what are you going to do now? And I think my answer to that was, I'm going to abseil down the Humber Bridge and I'm going to do it for charity. And I think I've always had that attitude that this isn't going to stop me. This is just a different way of living, not a sad way of living at all. And in fact, I've probably done an awful lot more since losing my sight than I did before losing my sight. My sight went suddenly, and then, you know, I was more or less offered daycare services, like, you can go to the day centre. And I was like, what, I'm 38, so I don't want to be in a day centre. How do you go about meeting other blind people, and how do you go about you know, learning the ropes, really.
And do you think that writing about that and exploring that has helped you find your own voice to express your individuality?
Yes, it was a learning curve writing the book. I think, you know, one of the things in the book is my daughter writes about the morning my sight went.
Mm.
She has a chapter in the book, and when we sat down to write it, when we were writing our book, we were both writing our chapters, we didn't speak to each other about it until after the chapters were wrote, and we then paired them together to see how much difference her memory was to my memory, and it was more or less identical.
Presumably with very different emotions for both of you.
I mean, yeah, you know, I'd gone in and I'd tried to sort of make it really soft. I'd gone into her room and I sort of said, what are you wearing today? Where are you going? What are you doing? Did you sleep well? And as I left the room, I went, oh, by the way, Mum can't see very well this morning. I did it as like an afterthought because I didn't want the shock to hit her. So I knew I had to tell her, but I did it as very much like it's not something important. But whereas when she writes her bit, it was like Mum had this long conversation with me and then just sort of drops the bombshell as she walks out the room. Looking back now, I think, well, yeah. I always remember the day I lost my sight and I went into the bathroom and I realised that when I looked into the mirror, I couldn't see myself looking back. And I remember sort of sitting, thinking, what am I going to do? But the pain of thinking, is this something really serious, something really deep down stomach churning feel, to suddenly think that I had to then tell my parents and my children, and I didn't want them to feel that pain.
So do you think in some ways that actually by writing your biography, you have finally got round to processing how you think about your blindness?
Yeah, I mean, writing the book was an amazing experience. You know, I came out with lots of stuff, which was probably quite deep-rooted inside me about losing my sight. But it also, I was very, right from the beginning, I was like, no, blind people can do anything.
Would you ever have been an author had you not gone blind?
I would have never have even thought about being an author. I love books. I've always really, really loved books. I've had lots of interest in books. I never thought I would be able to be an author. I think, you know, this sort of losing my sight has made me think, has made me challenge myself as well to things. And, you know, I wanted to read books and hear about what blind people do, how they manage. So producing that book was, you know, and it also says things because people sort of stop me in the town and go, oh, you're training that dog? And I say, oh, no, it's my guide dog. And they're like, oh, you don't look blind.
Mm.
And it's about explaining to people what, you know, different levels of sight loss and explaining about, you know, how you do things. I think people think we just sit there doing nothing until somebody comes to help. A lot of friends and family who have read the book have come and, like, really, you know, they'll come with a paragraph about something I've said or something I've done, and they're like, I get it now.
Diane Woodford, thank you so much for sharing the story of your own book, Living with Sight Loss, with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio.
The last bit of sight is gone. The truth that you've tried to avoid for so long is staring you in the face. Your sight is not going to come back. The feeling of panic you have been fighting off crowds in and takes over. You try to keep up a brave front before your family, never say die. But behind the front is the lump in the throat that won't go away. You can't believe it's happening to you. Questions that seem to have no answer haunt your mind. Why me? That's the first one. The question that shakes your ego, your self-confidence, every image of yourself that you ever built up and believed in. You get over it as the bigger, more important questions move in, the ones that won't go away. How am I going to tell my family, my friends? How can I face them? How do I earn a living?
How can I support my family? How can I continue in my profession, find a job, make a life? What happens to all my dreams and hopes and ambitions?
Al Sperber was an American author, radio presenter, and champion of rights for blind people. In the 1970s, he presented a show called Out of Sight, for and about the blind in New York. His book, which has the same title, features the stories of 10 people who appeared regularly on the show. The book's subtitle is 10 Stories of Victory Over Blindness, and that's what made me pick it up in the first place a few years ago. I wasn't in the best mood about my own sight loss and was looking to pick a fight with anyone who might tell me that there could be a quick fix. However, as soon as I was reading the foreword, I realised that I'd got hold of the wrong end of the stick and that if I read on, I might learn something.
If you are reading these words with the eyes you were born with, you have a startling and thought-provoking experience ahead of you. If you are reading these words with the tips of your fingers or listening to them on tape, or seeing them in type 2 inches high through the tunnel of narrow vision, don't say, "Pardon me, this is where I came in," and turn away. The blind have a lot to tell each other, so stick around and take the tour with your brothers and sisters who have normal vision. I did say tour because this book is a kind of tour through the world of blindness. It touches most of the high spots and many of the low ones as well. Those of you with sight will find the blind world familiar yet strange in 100 obvious and 1,000 subtle ways. That's only to be expected. We all live in the same world. Just because we blind are out of sight does not mean that we're out of this world. We're very much a part of it. We share it with you, the sighted. And we have to contend with it, just as you do, and in much the same way, but with a little something added, a small but important twist that fate has given to our lives. For perhaps the first time in your life, you'll be looking at the world from a new angle and fresh perspective. You will see it as we, the blind, see it. Those of you who are blind will probably know where you are every minute of the tour. It will seem all too familiar, an old hat, and you may wonder what you can possibly learn from the experience. Did you ever reread a favourite book and discover new meanings in it you never noticed the first time around? Something like that may happen to you reading this book. You may find yourself rereading the story of your life, seeing meanings in it you never saw before.
In the chapters that follow, we get to know a diverse group of men and women, blinded by a range of different causes. In addition to the ever-chirpy Sperber, who lost first one and then the other retina in a series of bungled attempts to reattach them, there's the talented sculptor who lost her sight to uveitis, the nun blinded at birth in a medical accident, and two former soldiers, one blown up during World War II, the other diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa after a disastrous night exercise and just before he would have been sent into combat. Both men learned that blindness is not a fate worse than death.
By the time I got back, my commanding officer had been informed of my condition. He blasted me to Chicago and back. You could have cost the lives of all the men in this outfit. Why didn't you say anything? What could I tell him? I was scared. I didn't want to desert my buddies. I didn't believe there was anything seriously wrong with me. 2 or 3 months later, the battalion shipped out. I was heartbroken. I'd been placed on limited duty status, given jobs around the company area, like the fireman and permanent KP, while my buddies finished their training. They went to North Africa for advanced training and then took part in the invasion of Sicily, during which they suffered heavy casualties.
He went on to retrain as an accountant, and Charlie Boswell, the soldier blinded in battle, became a blind golf champion with a remarkably low handicap. Boswell's twin mantras, "As long as a human being keeps driving forward, something of value might be accomplished," and "Lives frustrated by physical misfortune can be turned into new directions by new interests," are words that could apply to all of the lives featured in this book. I was especially struck by the immense wisdom of the New York judge, whose retinitis pigmentosa seemed actually to have enhanced his ability to do his job, also by the story of David Scott Blackhall, who created and for many years hosted BBC Radio 4's In Touch programme. He too was a writer, and his two volumes of autobiography, This House Had Windows and The Way I See It, are also available from the RNIB Talking Books Library as TB874 and TB1777, respectively. Reading Out of Sight, I was struck by how little things have changed in the 40 years since it was published. The blind community has huge potential. We're human, after all, but we still face the same old barriers. As Sperber writes,
"If you are sighted, you'll discover that the roads the blind must walk and the trails they must blaze are less secure underfoot and are filled with more pitfalls and obstacles than any to which you are accustomed. I'm not referring to the natural pitfalls of self-pity and despair and the obstacle of not having the use of one's eyes. I am thinking of obstacles that may surprise you, artificial ones that have been placed in the way of the blind by social forces called cultural attitudes and stereotyped thinking."
What makes this book different to the others featured on today's show is that it's a collection of biographies of blindness rather than a straight autobiography. As such, it was a timely reminder to me that my blindness is not unique, nor is it the only form of sight loss. But while many of the issues we face are the same, how we deal with them is down to us as individuals. There is no right way to be blind, which is why we all find one-size-fits-all solutions so frustrating. We all need to be accepted by a sighted world without feeling we have to surrender what makes us ourselves, our individuality. It's a process of trial and error. By writing about it, Sperber and all of us who record our experiences hope to share tips with blind and sighted readers alike, so as to spare someone in the future a few bruises. Some of the language in Out of Sight does feel a little dated now. The word handicapped has always set my teeth on edge, but Sperber's easygoing style of writing and humanity make it a good read. And yes, I did come away with a better understanding of how to approach life as a blind person. It'll never be easy, but by choosing the right goals for ourselves, we can make the journey more enjoyable. Out of Sight is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.